It's Friday, November the 13th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Before we start today, I just want to remind you that our next Inside Politics live event takes place next Thursday, which is November the 19th. It's happening at 7 p.m. And in that crunch week for negotiations on the future trade relationship between Britain and the EU, I'm going to be joined by our London editor, Dennis Staunton, along with Gideon Rackman, the Chief Foreign Affairs commentator with the Financial Times, to discuss the UK's future place in the world, what it means for Ireland as well. And I'm also delighted to confirm that we will also be joined by Helen Thompson, Professor of Political Economy at Cambridge University. So to join us for that live video discussion, just go to irishtimes.com/Britain Beyond Brexit. And the price of admission is €20, or it is just €10 if you're an Irish Times subscriber. So remember, that is happening next Thursday, the 19th. And to book your ticket, the address is irishtimes.com/Britain Beyond Brexit. Now, I'm joined today by our health editor, Paul Cullen, and also by our political editor, Pat Leahy, because COVID-19 remains really the defining issue facing the country and indeed the world. And there's been a lot going on in recent weeks and indeed in recent days, which may affect how the pandemic unfolds in Ireland and elsewhere and how we decide that we're going to cope with it. Paul, can I go with you first, and maybe with the big picture news item of this week? The big ticket item was obviously this announcement of successful trials of a vaccine.
Yes, it came out on Monday morning by press release from the manufacturer Pfizer, and it really electrified the whole discourse around COVID-19. Obviously, a lot of people are waiting for good news, and this seemed like the good news. There's a lot of money involved as well, too, and there's a lot of competition as well, because there's so many different rival vaccines, and now Pfizer seem to have stolen a march or got ahead of the other ones. A few points. I can't claim to be a vaccine expert, but I think what really got people was this assertion that, based on very limited data, I have to say, that the vaccine that they're testing is over 90% effective. And when you consider that the bar for effectiveness that being set by regulators was 50%, this is great news. You can't argue with that if it comes to pass, because it means that those taking the vaccine have a very high expectation that it will work for them. And the other good news, I suppose, as well, is that so far there are no safety issues arising from the 30 or 40,000 people who've taken part in the trial. So I would prefer if we got our news from our regulators rather than by press release from drug companies, but that's the way it's going to work. And there's going to be a lot of this in the months to come, because there are a few other contenders who are very near to having products ready towards the end of phase three trials. Obviously, there are caveats around this, loads of them. In the case of this particular vaccine, we've heard, obviously, there's been a lot of talk about the transportation requirements, very, very cold, minus 70 degrees. So that obviously puts the supply chain under pressure, and the fact that it has to be given in two doses separated by 3 weeks. So that also creates a challenge, but nothing insurmountable, I think. As we know, too, obviously, there's going to be a worldwide clamour for a vaccine that works. And the EU and the United States government and various governments around the world have been in negotiation with the various manufacturers. And we heard from the EU this week that they had reached agreement for a supply of 300 doses. So I presume that's for 150 million people of the Pfizer vaccine, should it come to pass. So, yes, this is great news. It's not immediate news. In terms of rollout, I can't see how there would be any meaningful rollout this year and even into early in next year. And perhaps when we're talking later about the phasing of what's going on with surges and so on, we'll talk more about that, because it does, it will have a bearing on what our future policy is in relation to controlling the virus.
My understanding, I mean, this is a politics podcast, obviously, so I'm driving outside my lane a little bit in terms of this sort of subject matter, but is that if the success of this vaccine is proven to be the case, we can expect a couple of the other ones to come down the pipeline pretty fast, because they're also based on what is quite cutting edge technology around bioscience and genetics and RNA, which is essentially what they're taking to to create this platform, which is the basis for the vaccine.
Yes, in other words, if this platform works for Pfizer and its partner in Germany, then it's going to work for some of the other people who are taking this approach. Yes, but we're, as I say, we're operating on limited data and we're not hearing from the regulators yet. Some of the contenders are taking the same approach without getting into too much of the detail. Some of them are using this novel approach and others are using more traditional approaches, which on the face of it would seem a safer bet in terms of if it's worked for other vaccines, then it should work for this one. And we know how to store and transport it and administer it. And we know its safety profile and so on. So, but I mean, as an each way bet, that's pretty good, you know. So the novel technology is showing signs of success. And then we have other products based on more traditional technology. Now, there has been no vaccine for a coronavirus, and even our flu vaccines aren't great. So, you know, let's not get ahead of ourselves, I suppose.
But I suppose the key number really, isn't it, is that 90%, which is, if proves to be the case, is just way ahead of expectations and just changes the fundamental mathematical calculations which underlie modelling things like herd immunity, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Really, I thought the bar was very low at 50%. So if you were taking a vaccine that only half worked, for example, then what exactly are you doing? You know, so once you've taken this vaccine, it's a psychological response that you probably become a bit more complacent and you think that you're protected and you go out and about. But if you're only getting half, 50% protection, then you're actually perhaps putting yourself at risk. And you're also putting the rest of the people at risk by potentially transmitting a virus that you didn't know that you could protect, that you thought you could protect yourself against. But if you're getting into 90%, that's really very high levels, and that's in conformity with the best vaccines we have for other serious illnesses.
And it allows us to compensate for the fact that not everybody's going to take this vaccine. There will be some resistance at some point. You can still achieve, one might hope, quite high levels of take up among the population as a whole. And with 90%, that could achieve the kind of thresholds that are required to start really suppressing the disease.
Yeah, I see it fitting into the jigsaw of the solution to this situation, because what we have is obviously we don't have a vaccine at the moment, but we do have more and more people who have experienced the disease and therefore have some sort of short-term immunity. So that will also play into it. And then there are people who are who will shield, hopefully, and they should probably continue to shield for quite some time unless they get protection from a vaccine. But we do, as you mentioned, we will have to address the issues of vaccine hesitancy. There will be vaccine resistance, there's no doubt about that. And a lot of questions will be asked of any new product that comes on the market, and rightly so. But the wider issue is one of vaccine hesitancy, where people are reluctant to take something that's new, or that they perceive that their risk is quite low. And some of those, in many cases, the risk is low, but they may have to be convinced that society more generally would benefit from them taking the vaccine to protect others.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was listening to a scientist this morning talking about this, and he was talking about, yes, there is a certain amount of unknown in such a new technology, but that if you were to measure up the risk, he as a scientist would say that the risks from what we know so far, even about long COVID, were you to contract long COVID, he says that that's a much higher risk factor if he were weighing up the decisions between risking that or taking a vaccine.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this. Long COVID is increasingly attracting attention, and we don't know enough about long COVID. I've seen figures quoted, and when I drilled into the figures, long COVID was defined as any symptom that lasted more than 28 days. That's not, for me, a long enough term analysis of that particular condition. Undoubtedly, there is an issue around the longer term effects from COVID-19 from people who overcome it, even when they haven't had a serious initial experience of the disease. But I think it's far too early to be making sweeping statements about the impact of long COVID. It's something to be factored in and probably being used as an argument for persuading people to take the vaccine. But I just think it is too early to make pronouncements on long COVID as we stand. It's not unusual for people suffering from any respiratory or viral illness not to suffer sequelae or consequences that last for a period of weeks or months or possibly up to a year. And it probably certainly anybody who's suffering anything after a year has got a particular health condition that needs to be addressed and collectively in the case of COVID-19, if that's what's happening. But certainly from talking to frontline doctors, their views are not bullish about it, I have to say, so many of them anyway. Now but against that, there are studies there that are pointing to areas of concern.
As you said, we're going to talk a little bit later about the reality of what this might mean over the course of the next year as we move into this very new phase of dealing with the pandemic. But just one question, because I've heard a lot of optimistic prognoses about rollout. Should this pass the necessary governmental regulatory mechanisms over the next couple of weeks, I've heard people, reputable people, say that they expect to see rollout beginning in December and ramping up into January, starting with the most vulnerable populations, perhaps people in care homes and things like that, moving on to frontline health workers, with a situation with a much greater rollout by the middle of spring. That seems optimistic to me. How does it seem to you?
Well, obviously, the first step in that chain is approval for a product. We know that the manufacturer is already making doses, large numbers of doses, and says it will supply large amounts of the drug to around the world even before the end of this year. However, I've seen different figures quoted for what Pfizer can offer, from 100 million to 50 million, so on. So I'm taking that with a pinch of salt. I, in answer to your question, I think it's slightly optimistic, but... we have seen, like, if you look at the enterprise of developing a vaccine, we've seen that fast tracked. As up to now, no vaccine has been developed in shorter than 4 years, and usually it takes 10 to 15 years. So we've seen that sped up to a massive degree. So there's no reason not to believe, given the level of enterprise, the level of incentive in terms of profit, and the level of cooperation internationally, that we won't see records broken in terms of supply chain and delivery to people.
Pat, if I could go to you, are there, I wouldn't say champagne glasses clinking in government buildings, but is there a sense perhaps that it's time now to readjust timeframes in terms of thinking about the economic supports that have been put in place and the logistical elements and the strategic elements for how the government is going to deal with the pandemic and its consequences next year? Is there some sense that they might have to be adjusted perhaps in a positive way?
I don't think so, to be honest, Hugh, at least not yet. I mean, the government's, the strategy that it is undertaking at the moment has been for some time based on the expectation that there would be a vaccine sometime next year. Now, this may be coming, the news this week may indicate that development may be coming sooner than had been hoped. But I don't think that it will change the government's fundamental approach. I think in two ways it influences. And if you think about the range of possible responses that governments can take to the pandemic, at the one extreme, there's the zero COVID option, and at the other extreme, there's the kind of herd immunity option. The Irish government is somewhere in between those two absolutes. Now, that does give us the model that we've talked about here before, which is lockdown, open up, lockdown, open up, in which restrictions are going to be a part of our lives for the foreseeable future, at least until the vaccine is widely distributed. But I think that approach isn't going to change for the government. What it may do, I think, in two respects, is it may actually bolster the government's adherence to that model, in that if more lockdowns are required, or at least the tightening of restrictions after the Christmas opening up, which is what is anticipated, but is the thing that is terrifying many people in government, that you've got to go back to restrictions in January, I think they will be more bearable with the vaccine much more clearly on the horizon than it is now. It also means that the economic cost of further lockdowns, or at least further restrictions, will be, I think, considered to be more bearable because, again, it is more definitively for a short term. So I don't think it'll change the, in answer to your question, I don't think it'll change the overall approach, but I think it will encourage aspects of it, such as a return to some restrictions after Christmas, if that is what is required after a period of opening up.
Paul, how are we performing in this phase of the pandemic now? I mean, we're not alone among European countries in having a significant second wave hitting us in the autumn into winter period. We are not alone in reintroducing pretty strict restrictions, although not as strict as they were back in the spring. We're not alone in seeing a surge of cases, but it seems to be plateauing or declining at this point.
Oh, we're performing amazingly. There's no word for it apart from that, Hugh. We are best in class for ending surges of coronavirus cases. Second time we've done this, in fact. We weren't able to stop the second surge, but then neither was most other places in Europe. But we are currently, along with Finland, the very best in the countries covered by the European Centre for Disease Control in terms of the fall in the number of cases and now in terms of our overall incidence. In fact, we've just moved from the red zone to the orange zone, and there's hardly anywhere in Europe that's in an orange zone. So we've done really, really well. The question is, how come we've done so well? And that's what we're not so sure about, because we've had a lot of different types of restrictions and levels of restrictions. We've had level 2, level 3, level 5, level 3 plus. We've had local ones, we've had national ones, we've had tweaks and so on. So it makes it very hard to work out what exactly worked and what didn't work. The officials in NPHET are quite clear. They're saying that level 3 we found was sufficient to put us on an even keel. But by that stage, a month or two ago, we had too many cases. And we needed level 5 to get down to, they're talking about an or not of reproduction number of 0.5. And that will get us down to 50 or 100 cases a day by the start of December. Now, not everybody agrees with this analysis. Many people would point out that actual cases and or not values peaked well before we introduced level 5. In response, the chief medical officer has talked about, well, actually, there was anticipatory behaviour by people before the introduction of level 5. In other words, he was arguing that although we only introduced level 5, I think it was the 21st of October, people knew it was coming and they started pulling down the hatches and being more careful as a psychological response to the impending change in restrictions. Anyway, it's a bit of an over and back. And there won't be absolute clarity on it, because you can probably argue both sides. But it is encouraging in that it seems to be accepted by the public health officials, who obviously have been driving a lot of this policy, that level 3 is sufficient to hold the line. So that if we do get back down to low numbers of cases in early December, level 3 should be sufficient to keep us there. Now, there's one problem. And that's Christmas, which, of course, is a special time of the year, special time for socialising, special time for travel. And so that raises a whole separate set of issues and challenges, which haven't been, you know, the response to which haven't been set out yet, but will be set out in the weeks to come before the level 5 measures end on the 1st of December.
And we're already seeing smoke signals from some members of the government, for example, Leo Varadkar this week, Pat, about what level 3 Christmas surprise might involve.
Yes, that's right, Hugh. I mean, Tánaiste Leo Varadkar yesterday in the Dáil talking that people saying that people shouldn't book flights home for Christmas, kind of a harder message than delivered by Tony Houlihan a number of hours later when he talked about travelling home for Christmas as non-essential travel. Some eyebrows raised in government about that because that is a decision people in government feel more properly that would be made by them on the advice. They would consider the advice of the public health experts, of course, but it is put to me forcefully by a couple of people that that these are decisions to be made by government. And I think that, you know, that goes back to the ongoing difficulties in the relationship between NEFED and the decision makers in government. And just going back to what Paul was talking about there, about the, you know, what a, you know, the restrictions or the level of restrictions that gave rise to this dramatic fall in the number of cases that we've seen in recent weeks. And I wrote a little bit about this in last Saturday's paper, that it is very keenly appreciated in government that the cases peaked on the 19th of October. That was the highest number of cases we've ever had, at I think 1,284. And that was the day that the government decided to introduce level 5. So had the government, another way of looking at this, I think, is had the government, and again, this is something that's keenly appreciated in government, had the government done on the 19th of October what it did 2 weeks earlier, when NEFED made its previous push for the introduction of a level 5 lockdown, and said, no, let's wait a week, then a week later it would have become apparent that the cases were beginning to fall off. All of which is a rather long-winded way of saying that there are people in government who think that level 5 was unnecessary, that cases had begun to come under control before the effects of level 5 were introduced. And as such, I think, while there is nobody talking about getting out of level 5 prematurely, I think that they, you know, I think that that difference of opinion between the government and NEFED as to the desirability of level 5 back 3 weeks ago is something that can't be ignored when they come to make the decisions about the Christmas restrictions. That having been said, there are two big, and there are multiple conversations going on in government in both a structured and an unstructured way about this at the moment, as I understand it. There are two big concerns that the government has. One is about the about allowing foreign travel into the country and the traditional influx of people coming home for Christmas. And the other is about the prospect of opening the pubs over Christmas. And I think that there is currently considerable attention being given in government as to how to mitigate those two threats, whether that means that pubs will be able to open only in a very restricted way, or not able to open at all. Those decisions haven't been made yet. Similarly with foreign travel, it seems unlikely that it will be ruled out altogether, but I think you will hear ministers and public health experts repeating those messages that we heard yesterday in more forceful terms over the coming weeks, along the lines of don't come home unless you absolutely have to.
And what about all the stuff of families gathering, different groupings of different people in different households within days of each other, all those kinds of issues? Because some people have suggested that there's been an over-concentration on shutting down businesses, whereas in fact a lot of the problems that arose in the second half of the summer were actually because of social contacts within households.
Yeah, that issue is under pretty lively consideration behind the scenes, as I understand it, at the moment. And those decisions haven't yet been taken, but they will have to be taken pretty quickly, because I think the government will have to have, I mean, next week it's due to have its 4-week review of the existing lockdown. No expectation anywhere in government that that will be lifted, as I say. But I think by then they will have to have pretty much underway a plan for the reopening. I think on that point that you make about, you know, where are the infections coming from? How dangerous is retail versus gatherings in people's homes? There is, and the Taoiseach has mentioned this in the Dáil, and I've been speaking to a couple of people about it, that there is an exercise underway at present. I think it's Ernst & Young that are helping officials process some of that data as to where the principal danger for the spread of infections comes. It's interesting to me that, as far as I'm aware, that is being done under the auspices of the Department of the Taoiseach rather than in the Department of Health or by NPHET itself. And I think that signals a sort of a shift in terms of where the locus of decision-making power will be when it comes to the what sort of restrictions will be in place over the Christmas period. One of the other things, just to finish the point, one of the other things that I'm hearing is that there may be a graduated opening up so that you may go to level three on the 1st of December, but there may be a further relaxation then, or some aspects of a regular level three restrictions may be eased maybe just before Christmas for a period of a fortnight or so, or 12 days, presumably.
So Chris Ray's driving home for Christmas will be banned from the airwaves until December the 21st or something of that sort. Paul, listening to Pat there, it strikes me that a couple of the key elements there are bits that we haven't done well on in the past and that have come under criticism. One is this question of having sufficient testing to find out where infection is actually really spreading. There was quite a lot of contention about that, you know, a month or two ago. The other one is in relation to international travel and the lack of any, you know, enforcement really, or even monitoring of you know, people restricting their movements or quarantining or whatever is required of them, depending on where they're coming from. Has that really got any better since?
Well, on the first point on testing, we actually do have enough testing at the moment. We our capacity is good. Turnaround time could be a bit faster, but couldn't it always? To be honest, there's a general point to be made about testing is that the ideal test for this disease hasn't been found yet. It's a mess. You know, it's expensive, it's laborious, it takes time, it has to go to a lab and so on. There are problems with false negatives and false positives, and that's universal across the world, you know, so everybody's struggling with that. But at least we do have the capacity. We seem to be resistant to using that capacity when the overall demand drops so that we don't go off hunting for it in specific areas. And I think we should do more of that. I wonder, is that for budgetary reasons? On the international travel, I was at the NPHET briefing last night and I asked the Chief Medical Officer, Tony Holohan, I said, well, how would you be about an Irish person coming home from Finland? Finland has got the lowest incidence in Europe. It's well below ours. It's been like that for yonks. And it wasn't something he would countenance. He didn't want to talk about specific countries. But basically, there's a one-size-fits-all approach. Don't do it, basically. Which, as during the summer, ignores the fact that the levels can vary hugely from country to country. And there is an industry out there that is dying effectively, the aviation industry. Another question that came up in the briefing for myself and from others was the obvious fly in the ointment, the blind spot of the officials and of the government, which is the nearest border here is with Northern Ireland. Now, I looked back for an article I'm writing at the moment. I wrote a problem about difficulties in cross-border cooperation in coronavirus on February the 8th. That was 3 weeks before the virus even came to Ireland. We've been told ever since that the cooperation is great between North and South. And yet the level of outcome and the issues that have arisen between the two jurisdictions has yo-yoed right through the summer. And it is worse now than it's ever been. As you know, the incidence in the North is over four times what it is here. As you know, the executive up there is going to let cafes open from next week, and even though their lockdown is only half worked. So there's a real problem there. That's the nearest border. That's the live border that we have. And yet nobody is talking about this. And you cannot, in conscience, tell people who want to be reunited, who live abroad, Irish people or whoever they are, and who live abroad and want to be reunited with their families, that you can't come home, and yet say nothing about travelling up to Belfast or back down to Dublin. I just cannot understand that. Well, I can understand it, actually, I suppose. It goes to a core value in politics that's came with us right through the 20th century. But it is a real problem, and it is a real problem for the solution next year after this surge is dealt with, because as we can see, the highest levels of cases are in Donegal and along the border. And although officials don't want to hear about words like sieve, it's common sense that that some of the high levels that we've seen in border counties is related to what's going on in Northern Ireland.
That really is very, very worrying, Pat, isn't it? And obviously, it's a complete political mess in Northern Ireland. The discussion has been completely politicised, which is never really a good thing in Northern Ireland. And we're seeing the outcome of that. Is there anything at all that the government can do on this side of the border?
I get no sense that there is a willingness to address this particular issue. And I think it'll get worse, particularly if they open the boozers in Northern Ireland, which they intend to do, and pubs remain closed down here. I think you'll see very significant cross-border traffic to avail of this facility, and inevitably that will re-import the virus back into border counties. But I don't get the sense that there is any agenda in government to tighten border controls, which is the only thing that you could that you could do to counteract that. I mean, people aren't supposed to travel between counties, but there's obviously an awful lot of cross-border traffic going on that will only intensify, particularly, as I say, amongst young people. If the pubs are open in the north, they're not open here. It isn't hard at all to foresee what's going to happen then.
The fear that's expressed, Paul, maybe we'll take this one finally, is that if there's, some relaxation, which everybody expects in December, and some allowance made for the need for families to get together over the Christmas period itself, and we're then at some version of level three, that the third wave hits. How realistic is that expectation? And given all the other stuff we've talked about vaccines and various other kinds of things, can we perhaps start to think, by the time the third wave's hit, other things will be coming into play, so perhaps we don't need to worry about it so much?
Yeah, I've always been of the view, or at least from an early stage in the pandemic, that what we were going to see were successive waves of the virus, but each successive wave would be less onerous or less damaging than the previous one. And so in this second wave, while we've had high case numbers, that's a bad measure of what's going on. We've seen that our hospitals have been able to cope. And for weeks now, the number of patients and the number of patients in ICU have been stable. So I would expect that a third wave would see a further improvement in that, because hospitals are learning how better to treat patients. Younger people are the ones being affected, who are less likely to become seriously ill. And there are various new ways of protecting and minimising cases. So I think there is reason for hope. There's a specific play of time with the vaccine being developed. And, it is the unspoken policy of government to sustain these repeated waves, I think, and then hope for a vaccine. So I think for my tuppence worth is what's going to happen is we will see some loosening of restrictions from the 1st of December, possibly shops, so to encourage commerce and so on. And there will be restrictions on movement, which of course encourages shop local, so that can be sold in that way. And then you go back to remember when Christmas had 12 days in it. And I think then you will see a further loosening for the core period of Christmas to allow something approaching a normal Christmas for people, maybe with some restrictions on how many people can be in your house and so on like that. And then we will pay for that to some extent after in the new year, and how much we pay depends on how far our case numbers start to rise again. But we do know better how to control things. So then in coping with the arrival of a third wave, so we have hopefully we're going from a lower level. We know what measures, what restrictions work and what levels can be fine-tuned to make things come under control. We have better ways of dealing with patients in hospitals, and then we have the prospect of a vaccine coming on. So taking that, we might just have 2.5 waves and then this thing might be over.
Yeah, Pat, I was quite taken by a statement from the president of Germany's disease control body yesterday, where, and I'm quoting from the German here for you, "We have to clench our butt cheeks together for another couple of months yet." People girding their loins in government buildings for that?
Let Let us all together clench our buttocks one more time in the hope of suppressing the virus.
I knew you'd like that.
I think they should put that on Christmas cards, Hugh. Let us all clench our buttocks together in a seasonal fashion, and perhaps families could get together and clench their buttocks together.
On that convivial note, we will leave it. Thanks very much indeed to Pat and to Paul. Thanks to our producer, Suzanne Brennan. And remember, if you want to get in touch with us, we are always delighted to hear from you. Just email us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. Until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening.